Hello, everybody, and welcome to this podcast. We're going to be focusing today on gender equality, intersectionality, and the impact of COVID-19 in higher education. This podcast is part of a series of events that we're holding during February 2021 to focus on the impact that COVID-19 is having on gender equality in the higher education sector and looking at how we can continue to progress. I'm really delighted to have with me today Sarah Liu. Sarah is from the University of Edinburgh. She is a lecturer in gender and politics and chair and co-founder of the University of Edinburgh's BAME staff network, as well as co-founder of the Scottish Feminist Politics and International Relations Network. Sarah has been researching this area with a particular focus on intersectionality. We are really pleased to have her views today on how it's impacting on higher education. So thank you so much, Sarah, and it's a pleasure to have you here. So Sarah, I'd really be grateful if you could just give people listening to this podcast an overview of the intersectional impact that COVID-19's actually had on our society to date that we're aware of.
Sure. So COVID-19 has exposed and exacerbated the multiple underlying structural inequalities that cut across race, gender, and class in our society. And race has stood out in many instances in particular. We see it from the disproportionate high rate of infection and death of Black and minority ethnics from the virus. And although these are health concerns, the pattern of race-based difference is historically rooted in the structural racism from which racial minority communities suffer. Even before the pandemic, we know that racial minorities are already more likely to be working in lower paid, more precarious jobs, right? So that leads them to higher chances of unemployment when facing a public health crisis and an expected economic downturn. So socioeconomic class also appears to account for the extent to which individuals can protect themselves from COVID-19. For example, holding jobs that allow them to work from home, accessing adequate healthcare when needed. So the impacts of the pandemic also carry important implications that intersect with race and gender. It is estimated that more than 2 of the 3 million people holding high exposure risk jobs in the UK are women. Migrant women are also at the front line delivering health and social care. So while lauding the contributions of frontline workers, the UK government has implemented policies that actually worsen the existing inequalities faced by marginalized communities occupying these roles. For example, apart from employment deemed essential outside the home, state-level decisions to close schools and ask vulnerable populations to shield also have created dramatic increases in concurrent child and elder care responsibilities for mostly for women. So that really reinforces the gender roles, right? The gender norms in society. And we see this from numerous studies, right? A study that surveyed women and men in the United States and Europe found that women actually provided 15 more hours of unpaid domestic labor per week than their male counterparts during the pandemic. Another study also showed that women have been juggling since the pandemic started, while men have been bored. So men have found themselves in a situation where they're just bored. They don't know what to do with their lives. So this additional labor and having to juggle work with unpaid caring responsibilities in the domestic space really affects women's performance capacities in their unpaid employment. And these pandemic-related impacts on work performance will also have long-term consequences on women's careers as well.
And Sarah, in terms of women's careers and the higher education sector, are you aware or do you think impact in our society as a whole has been mirrored through higher education and its role as a major employer in our society?
Yeah, so there's mounting evidence, right, that demonstrates that gender inequalities have become more entrenched and that women's labor has been exploited and under-recognized during this time. But less is actually known about how this current crisis that we're all facing is being experienced by individuals with multiple marginalized identities in the higher education system, which is the research that my colleagues, Dr. Audrey Verma and Dr. Menzo Abel and I are working on, right? So we find that many staff have to go to work in person, right? They have to deliver in-person services such as teaching or working in the library, right? So this puts, again, going back to what I said earlier about how racial minorities disproportionately impacted by the health concerns of COVID-19. When staff have to go into campus to deliver these services in person, that really puts them in a danger, right? And some of the staff have to commute to work, they have to take a bus or take a train, right? That, again, adds to the chances of exposure to the virus, right? And also many academic staff in the higher education sector are perhaps more lucky in the sense that we get to work from home while these teaching staff or professional service staff have to be on campus, right? But even if our work environment and hours may be more flexible than others on the front line, we still see the severe division of domestic labor at home. This gendered division of labor is particularly challenging for those with caring responsibilities, right? Especially when nurseries and schools are closed and those with caring responsibilities are often women. Yet at the same time, the universities are still pushing for their academic staff to be productive in their research outputs, right? So we need to remember that we're all in the middle of a pandemic still, right? We're juggling childcare, we're juggling elderly care and all sorts of other caring responsibilities while teaching, while providing services and leadership, and while, you know, meeting the expectations of research. This is particularly challenging when universities don't provide other ways to alleviate caring responsibilities or loosen up their expectations and use meritocracy as a way to evaluate individuals' performances and contributions. So in the long term, it is really those with care responsibilities, health concerns, right? Again, who are mostly women, right? And people of color who are hurt the most. But of course, the impact of the pandemic on those working in the higher ed is not just gendered, right? It is intersectional, as racism and sexism have been historically rooted in the higher education. So for example, people of color are heavily underrepresented in both the student body and the staff body in most universities across the UK. And currently we have fewer than 30 Black women who have made it to full professors, right? Full professorship in the entire country.
Yeah, which is an incredibly alarming figure. Yeah.
It is, right? And then can you believe that, right? We live in 2021 and still we have fewer than 30 Black women in the four professors in the entire country. And other racial minorities tend to hold on fixed-term contracts and positions at the lower pay scale, right? So their positions are particularly precarious in comparison to the positions of their white counterparts, right? So when universities respond to the pandemic by having all sorts of cuts, such as redundancy, pay increase freeze, promotion freeze, or recruitment freeze, it is really those racial minorities, especially women, again, who are suffered, right? They're usually the first ones to let go when they experience a pay increase or a pay increase freeze or promotion freeze. It also means that it will take them much longer to catch up on the gender and racial pay gaps that they currently face. So just to give you an example, during COVID, I'm aware that some university terminated existing fixed-term contracts and froze associate lecturer contracts for the 2020 to 2021 academic year. And this policy seems to apply to all who hold such positions, right? It doesn't seem racist or sexist. However, we also know that a significant portion of those on temporary contracts are women or BAME academics, right? So for example, at this particular university, almost half of all female Asian academics are casualized workers, whereas only 28% are white men. Therefore, universities' one policy for all that seems to be fair is in fact highly inequitable in its impact, right? Enabling inequalities to accelerate more during COVID-19 than they otherwise would. So we can certainly say that everyone struggles with a pandemic, but the extent to which one struggles varies depending on their different axes of identities.
Thank you so much, Sarah. You've highlighted a range of issues there that higher education institutions might want to be aware of. Is there anything else in particular that they should be aware of beyond the issues you've raised in terms of the vulnerability of frontline staff on less formal contracts?
Yeah, so we know that the impact of COVID is intersectional, right? And we know that the COVID has only exacerbated existing inequalities. Institutions need to be aware of the different challenges that their staff face. First, this may be a good time to reevaluate why we're using meritocracy or mostly research outputs to determine one's worth and contributions to the university, right? We know that academic staff contribute more to the university beyond research through their teaching, through their services and leadership, their mentoring and their involvement in all kinds of activities. Yet, research output is the one that's used the most in evaluating one's credentials for promotion, for example. So such evaluations based on meritocracy hurts women and people of color the most, while their white male counterparts benefit from it, right? And secondly, universities have made many decisions very early on in response to the COVID-19 because they were worried about the financial constraints, right, made by the pandemic. Universities made decisions to cut staff, freeze pay, increase in promotion, and so on. However, we also know that some of the worries that university administrations had earlier on actually didn't happen. For example, the statistics show that the international student enrollment in the UK has actually increased, right, in the last year. So universities need to revert their decisions because their decisions have a long-lasting detrimental impact, again, mostly on women and people of color. And to give you an example, we know that racial and gender pay gaps exist in the higher ed. And promotion is one of the only ways in which women of color could catch up on their academic status as well as their pay. So putting a freeze on promotion really creates a barrier for women and people of color academics, especially those who are early career, right, in the long run. And however, I don't see any university really trying their best to help these early career scholars who are mostly racial minorities and women, despite their, I'm using my air quotes here, commitment to equality, diversity, and inclusion, right? Universities are not exploring other options such as freezing promotion and pay increase of those who are already above a certain threshold in terms of salary or title. And university could have called also for a voluntary pay cuts and implemented, even if it's just temporary, right, a 6-to-1 pay ratio. Most importantly, universities haven't made any financial justification or provided any financial evidence for these cuts, right? So if you asked me earlier if there are things that institutions need to be aware of, I think they're all very aware of these, the very things I just mentioned, the unequal impact of COVID and university decisions on staff. Yeah, universities, you know, really need to think about how they can recognize these issues and address them in a systematic way.
And certainly the impact that the pandemic's had on early career research is based commissioned VITAI to undertake research in the area, and it's found that there's been quite a significant impact on early career researchers who responded, and it's a significant sample that they had within the sector, so people might want to look at that. And in terms of staff support, it's one of the things that we always advocate within Advance HE is times like this, you know, how are staff being supported? There's a lot of focus at the moment on student support, student mental health. How are staff, you know, being supported?
So it's definitely a challenging time for everyone, right, including university administrations. But I think we also need to remember that the pandemic has been ongoing for a year now. So the university should have been ready and be more prepared to support both their student body and their staff body, right? However, I see very limited support from the university. So for example, like I said earlier, many people still have to go on campus to deliver in-person teaching, right? And yet we don't really see much support on how staff could travel or commute to work in a safe way. And like I said, you know, everyone really struggles with a pandemic, and yet we don't really see much support either on, you know, mental health, right, of the staff. And some universities are very kind in terms of how they support their staff from, you know, taking a break from everything, right? So I know that some universities allow their staff to take, for example, Fridays off. That's really good. I think that's a really good first step. But what is not considered is the fact that work is always going to be there, right? The workload is not going to disappear only because you all of a sudden start working 4 days a week instead of 5, right? So I think that kind of flexibility given by the university should be applauded. But at the same time, we also need to think about the flexibility doesn't really make the work disappear, right? So someone still has to do it. So it's just really just much longer hours for 4 days of the week rather than 5, right? And let alone some universities don't even provide that option, right? Some universities ask their staff to just take annual leave if they feel like they are feeling burnout, right? And it wouldn't be fair for me to say that university doesn't provide any support at all, because I think some universities do provide support. But at the same time, a lot of the support given by the university centers on research. So the university still, you know, have this mentality or this expectation of their academic staff to be productive, to produce research outputs, you know, to meet the next rev cycle. We've already started to think about that, right? So a lot of the support that is given is based on that, which is really good. But at the same time, it's ignoring the fact that the pandemic has an intersectional impact on staff, right? Like I said earlier, for example, university could have, you know, extra funding opportunities, right, to allow their staff to carry out research during this time. But if you are a woman with caring responsibilities, right, it doesn't matter if the university gives you some pots of money, you just don't have the time or the ability to really focus on work. So I think there's a lot of implications for support for staff. And I think there are ways in which, you know, such support could be more comprehensive and could be more considerate of people, again, with, you know, intersectional identities.
Certainly, even where staff are considered critical workers during this lockdown and able to send their children to school, or if they've got younger children and nurseries are open, there's still lack of wraparound care in terms of after school clubs and facilities and things. So yeah, it's that the day is still shortened in terms of those facilities not being available in the same way. In terms of policy making, what do you think could be done to ensure continued staff progression and to reduce these inequalities that we're seeing emerging or more pronounced in the sector due to COVID?
These are definitely trying times, right? We are definitely facing a lot of challenges brought by the pandemic. But I also think there are opportunities for us as well. I think this is a really good time to revisit the higher education system, right? So we need to think about how the university's neoliberal practices particularly hurt women of color, especially those who are at the early stages of their career, right? Like I discussed earlier. So in terms of policy making, I think we should think about why higher education is not provided for free, right? I mean, it is here in Scotland for Scotland students, right? But why is it not for free everywhere else, right? So if students are paying so much for their tuition, we need to ask, well, where does that money go? Right, we know that it certainly doesn't go towards its academic and services staff, as we see that, you know, we suffer from bad working conditions, pay gaps, and so on. Right, at the same time, we know that some university VCs make 13 times more than their staff. So these are issues that policymakers need to pay attention to, and to find a way to help the members of the universities foster a safe and equal environment where decisions are not autocratically or centrally made, and where decisions are not made to pursue the internationalization or neoliberalization of education.
That's an interesting one. Thank you. We've seen a lot of media coverage on students in terms of how they fared during the pandemic, testing, being within halls of residence, and a lot of focus has been on their food supplies. And I'm interested, though, in terms of the actual gendered and intersectional impact on students, because that isn't something that we've heard a lot about in the media. And I've seen wonderful sort of praise on Twitter for students who are juggling childcare as well as their studies. But beyond that, not much else. And I don't know if you've picked up on anything.
You're right. We absolutely don't pay enough attention to that, right? So many students experience the same things that many people inside and outside the academia experience, right? They juggle work and carry responsibilities. However, I think for many students, especially if they don't come from a privileged background, may find it particularly difficult, as many of them may become essential workers, right, during this time. For example, working in industries that require them to provide in-person services, such as working in supermarkets, to basically really just make ends meet, right? So we know that education is not free and it's not cheap. So the pandemic could really put a strain on students. I've heard stories about how, you know, some students are now forced to work multiple part-time jobs to pay for their tuition fees because their parents lost their jobs during the pandemic, so they couldn't help them out anymore financially. So imagine having to juggle schoolwork, possibly carrying possibility and on top of them work multiple jobs just to survive, right? And in addition to, you know, to class, right, the impact of class, I think one thing that we don't often talk about is also disability, right, in this situation. Some students may be immobile. They cannot leave their house for whatever reason, right? That could really put a strain on their mental health as well, right? So I think those are issues that we need to think about when university, especially when university think about providing support for their students, right? We shouldn't treat students as a homogenous group. Again, students like academic staff and professional services, students have intersectional identities that put them in a situation where they experience a pandemic in a different way. So it's really dangerous for the university to treat them as a homogenous group without recognizing their individual needs based on their, you know, individual identities.
As I mentioned at the outset, this month is about reflecting on the current circumstances and what's happening, the inequalities that have been very evident, but also how we can move forward. And part of that is looking at any positives that there have been coming out of the pandemic. And we are finding some, and we've actually going to be publishing research shortly on remote working and the impact that that has had on people and their ability to work productively. And just wanted to know if you had any thoughts in terms of, are there any positives that we could build on that have arisen from the pandemic?
I'm very happy to hear about all the things that you said, you know, are going to be happening, because I apologize in advance if I sound a little bit more pessimistic than optimistic. So I try really hard to think about the positives that we can build upon that have arisen from the pandemic, right? I think it's a good thing that people have realized that the pandemic has exacerbated existing inequalities, right? We see that from a lot of research that is being produced, and we see that from a lot of teaching, right, that is also being generated. So I think it's really good that we're focusing on that. However, I think what we do with that information or evidence is what I hope would all take into consideration when making decisions, right? So there's mounting of evidence of inequalities risen by the pandemic. So what do universities do? And how can students hold their universities accountable? I think this is definitely the time to start thinking about that, right? To start thinking, asking those questions, and to start making or holding the institutions accountable. And lastly, like I said earlier, I think this is a really good time to revisit the higher education sector, right? Why is it working the way it is? Why is it functioning the way it is, right? Why has it become neoliberal? Why is education not free anymore, right? So those are the questions that we need to continue pushing. And like I said, I think, the pandemic, in a way, is a mirror, right? It really has mirrored or reflected or given us a chance to reflect upon some of the sufferings and oppressions based on intersectional identities in the past. They're all sort of like out in the open, or at least more out in the open than before now. So this is a really great time to ask those questions.
Thank you, Sarah. That's really, really helpful. And I have the same thoughts. It's anyone, I hope, who sort of engages just in the mainstream news, reading newspapers, will really have some of the inequalities in our society laid before them on a very regular basis, often daily at the moment. So it does mean more people are aware, and you don't have to convince them as much of some of the stark inequalities in our society. It's nearly time to wrap up now, but before we do, I'd just like to ask if you've got any further thoughts, any issues you'd like to raise at all?
Yeah, well, I just want to emphasize again that, you know, 2020 and up until now has not been easy. In the middle of the pandemic, there was also Black Lives Matter at the backdrop. And many universities published open letters stating support for Black Lives Matter. However, universities continue to fail to address the systematic nature of racism entrenched within their institutions by, you know, making the urgent required changes to practices and operations. So I think if universities are serious about equality, diversity, and inclusion, as they claim they are in these open letters regarding Black Lives Matter, the most straightforward way, again, for them to fix these sexist and racist problems would be to revisit their decisions on cuts, like I discussed earlier, right? So we cannot really separate out the pandemic from, you know, the Black Lives Matter or all these other movements around the world now, because they're all interconnected. So I'm really hoping that institutions would pay attention to how they have exacerbated existing inequalities and the responses to COVID-19. And I really hope that members of the higher ed community will work together to hold institutions accountable. And students should also remember that they have, in a way, somewhat more power than staff. So students should learn about these issues that not only they themselves or their peers are facing with the underrepresentation or under-recruitment and so on, but and work with academic staff to create a better and more inclusive learning and teaching environment for everyone.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. You've provided lots of food for thought for us as Advanced HE, for universities who are our members, in terms of, I think, the impact that COVID-19 and the government's responses are having on our society and in turn our universities. And there's certainly some issues that we'll no doubt be picking up on more as this month continues. So I'd like to wrap up now and thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ellen. It was definitely a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you.